Now on another matter, the House of Representatives will pass a bill this week, probably before some of your constituents see this show, the school aid bill. And the House has already adopted and locked in a very strong anti-busing amendment, which has administration backing. Can this be stopped in the Senate?
I believe it will be modified in the Senate. I believe the anti-busing feeling still remains strong. I deprecate it because the courts are using busing with great discretion and only as an aid to desegregation, and desegregation remains a critical matter in the country. Now, they always dress it up in these amendments with the idea that somebody's trying to force racial balance. But that isn't true, because you can't force racial balance. The only thing that's legal under the federal constitution is a desegregated situation. That is not discriminating against black children, not just spreading them around because of a matter of policy, but not allowing discrimination against them. That's a critical element in the morality and the constitutional law of the United States. And the so-called anti-busing amendments really don't count for a great deal in fact, except that they tend to give a public climate as if there was something wrong with continuing the desegregation process. So I would like to eliminate it entirely because I think it's wrong, and I think the courts have been doing a good job in being intelligent and fair about it. I believe it can't be done, but I believe it will be materially modified.
What would be the consequences to our country, the internal situation, were the anti-busing amendment to become law?
I think it would throw the desegregation effort into chaos, and the real danger is not so much its prospective application, because the desegregation process has gone a long way. Although, it's interestingly enough, its concentration is now no longer so much upon the South as it is upon the North, the West, and the central part of the country. But I believe that it would endanger everything that's been done and would be an element of great social instability in making the black feel that you're in a reactionary period in which the gains that he's made, and remember, that's 11-12% of the population. It's a pretty big slug in the United States. The gains he has made will be nullified. So I think it's very, very unwise. Well, Sam, I'm afraid we've run out of time.
I have so many more questions.
Your questions have been, as always, very astute. You're one of our very best. But we've run out of time a little sooner than anybody ever thinks. Thank you very much, Sam Schaefer, the principal correspondent of Newsweek magazine, for being with me on this report to the people of the state of New York. And I hope the people who are listening will have found it interesting and will tune in to our next report. Hello, everyone. This is Senator Javits with another report to the people of the state of New York. As is our custom, I have a distinguished newsman here to ask me some questions, but first, a few subjects that I believe will interest our people at home. First, the minimum wage. It's very gratifying that the minimum wage has now become law on the part of the president. It starts at $2 practically immediately, goes up to $2.10 within a year, a little less than a year, and is $2.30 in 2 years. Now, for those who might be concerned about those figures, may I say that if you took the previous minimum of $1.60 and translated it into today's dollars, it would immediately be $2.17. This is going to benefit mainly people at the lowest end of the income scale, and many of them the near poor, so that it has a public impact, too, in cutting down the welfare rolls. And indeed, that coupled with tight administration and a little more intelligence in how we handle welfare is beginning to cut our welfare rolls, and it's very gratifying indeed. This reform on the minimum wage was long overdue. It also brings in under the minimum wage about 5 million local government workers, which is a great improvement, and we take full care of overtime for police and firemen and other similar employees so that nobody is incommoded or seriously made seriously costly as an employee. It also looks after 2 million of those in domestic employment, and again, with great care. that the housewife is not caught by surprise with some government regulation or government report. It's all handled so that she's got to be fully informed as to what she needs to do, and it's very easy to do it in paying that minimum wage. And we've also been a little bit more extended about the employment of college youth on the job, which is also very helpful with employment of young people. The other subject I'd like to mention to you is a bill I've just put in to encourage civilians, citizens, to help the police in many ways. Among the activities are auxiliary police, citizens patrols, tenant patrols in big projects, auxiliary and improved street lighting, merchant security, and many other things. I feel the federal government should stimulate this, and that it's a great aspect of the war on crime. And the last thing I'd like to report to our people at home is that we're just in the process of making into law a measure to put about $2 billion a year for 10 years into research to deal with the energy crisis and to make the United States truly independent in an economical way in terms of energy and the oil embargo and the other problems which we faced. Well, those are a few of the highlights of what's going on here in Washington. Now for our distinguished guest, I'd like to introduce to the people of New York Don Larrabee of the Larrabee Griffin News Service and a very prominent Washington newsman, former president of the Washington Press Club. Don, fire away.
Well, thank you, Senator. Apparently you disagree with your New York colleague, Senator Buckley, on whether President Nixon should go to Moscow in June. Senator Buckley says flatly no, and you say go, but with some reservations, I gather. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's correct. And my reason is that there is no replacement for a president of the United States. If a man is going to be president, he's got to do the job presidents must do. And one of those jobs is to try to arrive at better agreements with the Soviet Union, especially on the limitation of nuclear armament. This is what's beggaring them and beggaring us. And it's a two-man poker game. So anything that we and they agree on represents a net reduction to both. I don't think anybody can do that but a president. And my judgment is that the president should and must go. And if he feels uncomfortable that he can't handle it or that he's being obsessed by Watergate, the 25th Amendment allows him to lay down his responsibilities for as long as he wishes and recapture them when he wishes. Has nothing to do with his ill health or inability to do his job, just his discretion that he wants to turn over the powers of the presidency temporarily to the vice president. I think that is a very adequate outlet valve if he feels he needs it. And I also believe that in his visit, say for a week or 10 days or whatever it may be, the Congress will have enough sense not to do anything embarrassing. It isn't a long time. It isn't going to make any difference in impeachment or any other proceedings. So long as he's president, he's got to do his job, and if he feels he can't do it, it's his duty to give it to the vice president and let him do it.
And of course, I believe you mentioned the necessity for any agreements reached over there being considered by
Thank
Congress.
Thank you for reminding me. I propose to introduce legislation on that score to make it absolutely crystal clear that any agreement must be subject to the approval of Congress.
Well, now, what effect overall is this shadow of impeachment having on the administration's foreign and domestic policies, in your opinion?
I think there is some impeachment politics being practiced. For example, there's been a little feeling that they want to pull away from a few pending measures like the Consumer Protection Agency, which I consider very essential, the land use bill, which deals with such vacant land as we have in the United States, and other measures.
But it's the withdrawal of administration support.
Yeah, or the willingness of the administration to negotiate about them. Mm-hmm. But my belief is that's very temporary. I think the better example for the president is his agreement with the Congress, or with many of us in the Congress, on the Comprehensive Manpower Training Bill, which was a brilliant success as far as he was concerned. And in my judgment, he's got a much better trade-off if he's doing the job of a president and working out agreements with the Congress in terms of the people and even impeachment, etc., than he does if he plays impeachment politics. So I see some tugging and hauling on that score. The other thing, which I think all of us are concerned about, is that he might make some international deals because they'd build him up which might be improvident. But that assumes that we're fast asleep at the switch. And to reassure our people that we're not, we have the War Powers Resolution, which I'm very proud is mine, so that he can't go to war or commit us anywhere near war without our express approval. And I believe that he should make it clear to the Congress, and if he doesn't, we should do it by appropriate resolution, that he's not making any deals unless the Congress approves them. And I think those two give the people the necessary reassurance so that he ought to do his job.
The Senate has been somewhat absorbed in recent days in what we call a campaign finance reform bill, which I suppose is somewhat of a direct response to what happened in the 72 election campaign. But then we have Senator George Aiken, the senior Republican, saying it's really not much of a reform. It's loaded with hypocrisy and loopholes. Perhaps you heard him say this. Doesn't reflect too well on Congress. How do you feel about this?
Well, I feel that Senator Aiken is a very salty, marvelous New Englander, mm-hmm. great man, and very human. And he's kind of slyly giving us a little warning that we better not have an empty package that can be found hypocritical and full of holes. I don't believe it will be. I believe that what emerges will be substantially a limit on what can be spent in a campaign, a limit on what can be contributed, very strong publicity about what can be contributed. I hope a quotient of public financing, not to put so much of the strain of raising money on the candidate, and this is a subject I ought to know a lot about. I've had a lot of statewide and local races, and I'm thoroughly with that idea. Generally will have higher ethical standards and I think make a real improvement, basic, fundamental, and appreciable in the climate in which campaigns are run. So while I appreciate Senator Aiken's warning, I think we'll heed it.
I think he was a little concerned about those Vermonters having to go to the polls at 11 o'clock at night under that amendment, you know, which requires uniform voting time all over the country.
Yes. Well,
they get up early in Vermont. Maybe they don't stay up that late.
Well, I understand that, and the conference committee will consider that amendment. But it oughtn't to obscure the fundamental thrust of this bill, which is major and important.
And of course, it has to go through the House still yet.
It has to go through the House, be subject to conference. I only hope we get it through before this election. Indeed, I would like to apply it to this election, but that may prove to be impossible.
Well, at the moment, talking of this election in November and all, how do you see the impeachment timetable working? Are we in a situation where it could carry us into the November elections?
It could. I believe that it should, in the sense that people ought to get on record and action ought to be taken, and the House, in my judgment, should have moved by the 15th of May. That looks impossible now. Certainly, they ought to move well before the summer season actually sets in, and we ought to be ready for a trial within 2 or 3 weeks thereafter, if, it's a big if, of course, they should act affirmatively on impeachment. But I'll tell you what I think, Don, interestingly. I think the country is kind of getting adjusted to this idea. People are no longer as alarmed about it as they were with the installation of a vice president who's a very decent American, Gerald Ford. I think the country is beginning to feel that the system will operate, that it will survive, and that the country will not be dismantled by our going through this traumatic experience. It is traumatic, but I believe that a certain sense of confidence is beginning to be restored into the country, that America is bigger and stronger, that our institutions, our Constitution, are bigger and stronger than these strains. And that's a critical thing, because I think it'll move through the economy as well as through society. I'm not euphoric, and I'm not blindly optimistic, but I begin to see the feeling of the people that, quote, we can handle it.
The process is working, in other words.
Right.
Yeah. Well, now did you mention the pension reform bill?
No, I didn't, and I should.
How is that going?
It's going terrifically. It's going to House Senate conference imminently. It's a very complicated measure, but it passed the Senate 93-0 and the House 376-4. And it's considered by most legislators the hottest bill around here. And indeed it should be. And I believe we will reconcile our differences and that it will become law about the middle of the year. And that will give an assurance to millions upon millions of workers. There are 35 million under pension plans. And with this law, there will be more because we encourage them. We make it very fruitful to have more pension plans. They involve $150 billion in assets, and they're growing at the rate of $12 billion a year. And my objective, and I'm the fellow who started this in 67, and now I'm joined by Senator Williams of New Jersey and Congressman Dent and Congressman Mills, Senator Benson, Senator Nelson. Many very wonderful people have joined together, and I give them all the full credit in the world. But the end point is that a man or a woman will be able to retire at the given retirement age, after having put in 15 years of work on a particular job where there is a retirement plan, so that with the retirement and Social Security, he has a good chance to make it. Today, he doesn't. Mm-hmm. And the missing link is some effective retirement which accrues to you early enough so that you can really use it in terms of cranking it into your standard of living and depending on it. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time it'll be guaranteed. In addition, it's going to be locked in with federal government insurance for the pension. Now, we are backing that up with very adequate funding so that the money is behind the pension when the pension promise actually vests in the individual worker. I'll tell you, it is one of the most exciting reforms of this century, a reform fully equivalent to Social Security. Well, Don, I'm afraid that answer kind of used up our time. Your questions were crisp enough.
Well, thank you.
And
thank you very much.
Very glad to have Don Larrabee of the Griffin Larrabee News Service, or Larrabee Griffin, I guess it is, Don.
Well, either way.
To ask our questions here today, former president of the Washington Press Club. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen of New York, for listening to another report to the people of the state of New York. Hello, everyone. This is Senator Javits with another report to the people of the state of New York. I have a very distinguished journalist here as my guest today to ask some questions. But before I do that, I'd like to talk with you for a minute about some critical issues here in Washington. First, the issue of inflation. We have a 14% inflation current. That's unbelievable. It's been called, quite properly, by the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, South American, he really means Brazilian type of inflation, and it reminds one of the kinds of inflations which eliminate the value of all money. Now, I hasten to add, I'm confident this isn't going to happen in this country, but it's extremely dangerous and a great hardship to many, many people, especially with those with low incomes. Now, the Congress, in my judgment so far, ill-advisedly through the committees in the House and Senate, has not entertained any legislation for continuance of some form of standby wage and price control. I know we're going to dismantle the controls on specific industries, but we should have some residual ability to put it back if it really doesn't work out the way many predict, including the administration, that prices will adjust themselves through competition. So I'm for standby wage and price controls. And if no one else moves it on these various committees, I'm going to move it and give the Senate a chance to vote on it. And I will adapt the plan to what I think is feasible here and adequate to the situation under all these circumstances. But I'd like my people to know that. I do not see us putting ourselves in a defenseless position on this critical issue. I cannot understand that as any area of responsibility. The second thing I'd like to talk with you all about is that we've been having meetings here in the last week with 24 foreign ministers of the Latin American countries, in which I've sat with Dr. Kissinger, our very gifted Secretary of State. These foreign ministers have made it very clear that they urgently want improved trade relations with the United States. This is very much to our interest. So I'd like to emphasize that a trade bill is a high priority on my program, and I'm going to do my utmost to work it out. I realize there's a serious problem about what's called the Jackson Amendment, respecting the morality of the Soviet Union in terms of allowing people to leave the country for legitimate reasons. But I believe that we can find some way to deal with all issues, and that the Soviet Union's immigration policies are very immoral.
nonetheless should not be permitted to destroy the whole trade bill. I think that's a great error of the administration in taking that position. And finally, I'd like to say a word about taxation. There's an awful lot of conversation about tax cuts. Now, I appreciate that people in low-income brackets need some help with this inflationary situation. But the counterproductive way to do it, in my judgment, would be to cut taxes without making them up in some other department. So I will be against any tax cuts unless the total tax take of the federal government remains at the very least the same, and it's incorporated within tax reform. Well, ladies and gentlemen of New York, our distinguished guest today is Alan Emery, Washington correspondent of the Watertown New York Times. Alan, fire away.
Senator, if I could get a couple of questions, then I'd like to spend most of the time on the economy. But first of all, you sponsored a piece of legislation in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which was approved without dissent, to improve trade relations with Cuba. What prompted you to offer this piece of legislation?
Well, I mentioned here a minute ago about meeting with the 24 right. foreign ministers of Cuba. They seemed to feel that the time had come to try to normalize relations with this other country of the Americas, which is out of the OAS system. By the way, technically sanctions are still in effect against it. That is an embargo against doing any business with it. But there seems to be considerable sentiment to review that situation. It's not unlike the situation with mainland China. And for the stability of the Americas and the general feeling of cooperation with the other American countries, all I've done with that resolution is to ask that we have a new look at the Cuba policy, hearings, etc., to see what ought to be done. And I think that with the augury of the treaty, of an agreement, rather, which under which the Cubans are now returning hijacked planes, etc., it's kind of an opening which indicates a disposition to discuss matters. And after all, we're much better off with a secure Cuba than with sanctions against an obstreperous Cuba.
Senator, the second thing I'd like to bring up is Secretary of HEW Weinberger says that he will recommend President Nixon veto the school bill that you are supporting, whereas he would recommend that the president sign a different bill which has passed the House of Representatives. What is your reaction to that?
My reaction is that the different bill that has passed the House of Representatives is absolutely loaded against New York State and other comparable states. It's loaded against industrial states and tries to give a very special break to other states without recognizing, especially smaller states and allegedly poorer states, in terms of per capita income spread over their whole population. What it misses is that the pockets of poverty in New York with children from depressed families economically are so deep and so abysmal and are so incorporated in great metropoli like New York City that makes New York's problem even tougher than what might be a poor school district out in some country area in a state with a few hundred thousand population. Yet those states are more numerous than the big states. And remember, in the Senate, it's two votes a state. So that's what the administration is preying on. And I use that word advisedly, P-R-E-Y.
That's tough talk.
Very tough talk, because it's a very unfortunate and a very, not only deplorable, but I think a very unfair attitude on the part of the administration. And we have to fight it tooth and nail. We're entitled to a fair break in educating our poor and children from depressed families in economic terms, and to get the same break that small country states do, and they're not willing to give it to us.
Now, Senator, you mentioned wage and price controls. Do I read the administration position unfairly when I say the administration is for dropping controls, that they've allowed a situation to exist where interest rates are now going over the 10% mark, oil company profits are going anywhere from 75% to 150%, and high prices for food and gasoline are persisting, and the administration says they'll continue?
Well, you've rolled a lot of things into quite a big bag. The administration did ask for standby wage and price control, albeit not very enthusiastically, but they did. At the same time, affirming they were going to decontrol all sectors of the economy except health services and food. Now the Congress went and won better, that is the committees, the banking and currency in the House and in the Senate, and refused to vote any control legislation. It's now going to be up to people like myself, and I said that a few minutes ago, on the floor of the Senate to offer amendments for some kind of standby control. Now we have a good deal of support. for example, Vice President Ford, supports the idea of standby controls. He just said so the other day. So does the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, our Dr. Arthur Burns, very respected and very powerful. He supports some machinery. He doesn't, not the same as standby, but some machinery. So does Dunlop, who is the head of the Cost of Living Council, supposedly supports some machinery. So I think we have a chance, and I intend to do everything I can to make that chance good. I think it would be highly irresponsible to have no controls. Now, the other things you mentioned.
And how you read public opinion and reaction to those other things.
Well, I think the public reaction just can't be with the administration's doctrinaire feeling that controls are iniquitous and therefore we should not have them at the very moment when the kind of an emergency for which you have controls, and we've had them in war and out of war, is made. This is the kind of emergency with a sharply escalating price level and no indication that there'll be any change. Now, one other thing. It is said by the administration's apologists that if you let the free competitive forces operate, taking off all controls, they'll moderate price. That fails to take account, however, of the tremendous bulges in raw material prices like oil, which are going to take some years to surmount until our independence in that regard begins to assert itself. That'll take at least 3 years, in my judgment. So this is a moment when a temporary control mechanism can be helpful, taking us through a period which could be very damaging in inflation, which is exactly what controls are made for. And it's exactly the wrong time, therefore, to be doctrinaire against them. Now, you mentioned a few other things that I think I'd
interest
like to
rates
mention.
And high
right,
prices.
Right. Now, the high price situation is very heavily attributable to this very high base that's come into the economy on raw material prices and the fact, as our people have to face this, that productivity in the United States is very low. And that the normal increase in productivity, which our workers produce, which enables us to improve our standard of living, we're very deficient in today. We've got a margin of improvement of roughly maybe somewhere around 3 to 4%. Japan's got 20%. And many other countries in the world that are doing well have much greater, 3 and 4 times what we have. Interest rates reflect, again, it's the chicken and the egg proposition. Interest rates reflect inflation. The reason you've got a 10% interest rate is because everybody who's lending money for a year has got to figure that in that year, their money may be worth 10 to 14% less. That's the rate of inflation because the money is valueless except for what you can get for it. And if you can get that much 14% less because the prices have increased, your interest rate at 10% sounds cheap. So the government just haranguing about interest rates is not hitting any bullseye. It's not hitting a target. If it was for a standby wage and price control mechanism, then it would be hitting a target. Because that controls what makes interest rates.
But most of the people are talking about the public reaction to Watergate and impeachment. Don't you think really the people are more stirred up by the economic situation, the problems they face there?
Alan, without any question. And I say that with the danger that people will think, well, I'm laying Watergate aside. My record's too complete for that. I condemn it. I want the House to act immediately to deal with impeachment. I want the Senate to face its duty if that's the way the thing lies. But the fact is that to the individual Americans, deep long-term interest, this inflation is murderous. When you think of the fact that the value of money can be eroded in 3 years at this rate by half. That goes for savings. It goes for insurance policies. It goes for everything one owns in the way of money. And if you're going to have a flight out of money to tangibles like real estate or stocks or something like that, you could have a real panic in this country. So inflation, in my judgment, is the number one problem. And while one, feels deeply and works hard respecting Watergate, you've got to keep your eye on the ball in terms of the interests of the people. And their interests are to control inflation.
Some economists say that we're already in a recession. The White House says we're not and we won't be. Is this economic sloganeering? Does it really matter whether you use the term recession? We're in bad shape, Bob.
Definitely economic sloganeering. You've got unemployment rising, not yet catastrophic, at the same time that the price level is absolutely unacceptable. And to pretend that we're not in trouble, forget the word recession, we're in serious trouble. And some of the things that I've mentioned are critically essential to deal with that trouble, and others of the things that I've mentioned, like some arbitrary demagogic tax cut, could only contribute very seriously to the catastrophe. Well, Alan, I'm afraid our time's up. It's too short, I know. Thank you, Alan Emery, distinguished journalist, Washington correspondent of the Watertown New York Times. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening again to another report on the work I do here from Senator Javits, your senator.